Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond, who have a distinct perspective on time.
Welcome to Time Sensitive. On this episode, Andrew's in conversation with the art dealer, artist, writer, collector, and curator, Kenny Schachter. What'd you talk with him about?
So Kenny's someone I've long admired for his nonconformist approach to engaging with art and the market surrounding it. Kind of has this punk spirit about it. His reputation is that of a polarizing figure, of course, a wild child, but Kenny simply loves art. You know, he curates, he makes art, he writes about art, he lectures, he teaches, he also deals art. And I was most curious about exploring the thread that connects these disciplines and maybe some of the forces in his life, experiences that he's had over time that have shaped his perspective and approach. He's, of course, known as a proponent of NFTs, and we do get into that a bit. But the conversation was really more about Kenny's life and his point of view on time and family, and this relentless pursuit to democratize and break down the walls of the art world.
Before we jump into it, we'd first like to thank our Season 5 sponsor, Le Cole School of Jewelry Arts, which is supported by the Maison Van Cleef & Arpels. Celebrating its 10th anniversary this year, Le Cole promotes jewelry culture through courses, talks, exhibitions, publications, and more. With permanent campuses in Paris and Hong Kong, as well as through traveling schools hosted in cities around the world, Le Cole offers a large range of classes lasting from 2 to 4 hours, led by some 50 teachers, art historians, gemologists, jewelers, and artisans, all experts in their field.
Among the latest Le Cole classes debuting this year are courses on diamond grading, pearls, jade, emeralds, Art Deco jewelry, and jewelry from the 1960s to the 1980s. This fall, they're also hosting their first field study trip over 3 days from Dresden to Prague, during which a group of students will visit garnet mines, admire the Dresden green diamond, and come together for discussions with museum directors, curators, and jewelry restorers.
Le Cole will also be hosting a 2-day masterclass this fall on the art of collecting. Attendees will learn the nuances of and motivations behind building a jewelry collection, the secrets around purchasing, and the steps involved in conservation. You can find out more about Le Cole at www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. That's www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. And now, here's Andrew and Kenny.
Welcome, Kenny. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to begin today with a story you tell, which goes, my wife sat next to someone on the Basel selection committee, and he literally said, who does Kenny think he is? That he could curate, make art, write, and deal. He can't. And you go on to say, and you're telling the story, but I can and do and will never stop. For me, there's a continuous thread that connects everything I do. And so what I wanted to begin with is talking about that thread.
Should I start by putting my foot into my mouth?
You could do whatever you want.
Well, on one level, Karl Marx famously said, why can't you be an economist in the morning and a fisherman in the afternoon? And I took that to heart. And I think if you're not breaking the law or hurting anyone, why can't you do whatever you want to do? And that's what I do. Funny enough, the person who made that comment at that dinner, I subsequently wrote an article about a work that they sold from the gallery with false attribution that I heard from a good source was knowingly falsely attributed. I wrote that. I was threatened with a lawsuit against me and ArtNet. What I said turned out to be true, and this gallery no longer shows at Basel, and the person who did this was on the ethics committee of the art fair. which is kind of
perfect. It's not the first time we've seen this story.
This is just between you and I.
Of course. And everyone else listening.
Shh, don't remind me. But like, for instance, I lecture a lot.
Yeah.
I teach a few classes per semester, University of Zurich, NYU, sometimes School of Visual Arts, everything from studio practice to seminars on the machinations of the art world. The first art class I was ever in my life, I was teaching at the New School in 1992. But whether I'm curating, lecturing, making art, or writing, or organizing a one-person hoarder sale like I do every year at Sotheby's to clean out, do a little spring cleaning, for me, it's all a continuous thread in what I do. I mean, I could be pretentious and say it's my practice, and I'm like Joseph Beuys teaching, making notes on blackboards that become artworks, but I'm not that pretentious.
Let's get into maybe a little bit about what that thread might be thematically through all of these things, because in really engaging with your work and in prepping for today, some of it has to do with truth in how I see it, and this passion for understanding the moment we're in and trying to make that visible through time. And some pursuit of, it's not quite justice, it's not quite truth, and I'm asking a question, really. What is it?
Can I interview you about me? You know better than I do about my own activities. Due to the fact that I'm self-taught and self-wrought, I mean, I went to the Outsider Art Fair 2 weeks ago, and I very well could be exhibiting in the Outsider Art Fair, even though I'm firmly entrenched in the art world after 35 years of clawing my way to whatever position I've ended up in, I'll always have a perspective from outside. There's a famous Thomas Mann short story called Tonio Kroger, and the character is sort of longingly looking through a window from outside at this party going on that the character was never invited to. And I always feel like that. So as a result of that, I'm constantly observing the goings-on of the art world from afar. I never had a job, pretty much, ever. I'm unemployable, more or less.
You're the most productive unemployed person.
Thank you.
In the world. And that's partly because you're traveling all these different worlds constantly.
The art world is a language unto itself. It's an ecosystem unto itself. It's an economic model with no peers, its own language, its own... It's similar to the mafia omerta, where there's laws of secrecy, nothing is spoken about. So I guess I just like to pull the curtains back. I have been involved for so many decades. I see a lot of things, know a lot of people. I've been reporting for decades about the goings-on, the good, the bad, mostly the bad and the ugly and the worse in my column at ArtNet over the years, and then occasionally for the art newspaper, New York Magazine, and various other publications. But over the last couple of years, since I found out about NFTs and I've been able to, for the first time in my life, and I'm no spring chicken, I found a way to make a living from my own art. I embedded my videos into my writing, so I found a way to express myself and communicate, but I had all but given up hope of ever having the opportunity to participate in a more meaningful way in the art market. And that's changed. My whole life has shifted gear in the last chapter, more or less. And I've devoted more of my efforts and my time to mainly just writing, teaching, and making art. And I love to teach. The art world, I always say, the only word it knows is the word N-O. No, you can't do this. No, you can't say that. And it's all about prescriptive behavior and these unspoken rules, like I mentioned. You mentioned honesty. I didn't set out to be this person who robs information from the rich and shares it with the aspiring rich. I just hate hypocrisy. And look, I'm far from innocent. My hands are a little dirty, just like everybody else's. But I'm frank and I'm self-deprecating. I hustle every day. It's never easy. It's as difficult now as it was in the beginning, but I have more opportunities. People think that, oh, if you do NFTs or I'm well-known and have a big audience. I've been working 7 days a week for my whole career, and I'm 60 years old now, so I'm fucking old. Everything is hard fought, and it continues to be. I have no idea when my next sale will come, if it will come. I'm getting into trouble all the time. I have this kind of emoji I've created of myself. I should have the word sorry scorched on my forehead because I'm always having to say I'm sorry. And I don't have bad intent.
But you behave unapologetically.
I mean,
in a good way, I'm saying. Sort of like go for it.
Yes, I go for it because, look, you have one life and it's very short.
Yeah.
And I've been through a lot with my family. I've been through good things. I've been through unspeakable tragedies like many other people have. And art has imbued my life with meaning. My family is involved in art, my kids, and it's really the only thing I care about. I mean, the only thing I know a little something about. And I'm not going to waste my time or my energy. That's why I could never be an art dealer and I couldn't sell drugs to a drug addict because I just don't have the patience.
I want to talk a little bit about time. You know, in looking at your work, I've been curious about how you see the relationship of objects to time. You know, you have a certain reverence for objects, whether it be art, cars, anything, track pants that you collect. This idea of time and how objects sort of testify to what they've seen. Do they mark you back to periods of your own time? I mean, I want to get into specifically more collecting later, but just this idea about objects and time and your thoughts on that.
Well, I never really thought of the connection between the two, which I think is very interesting. I mean, I consider myself a materialistic aesthetic. I like being surrounded by the things that aesthetically please me and enrich my life and inspire me. But I'm not attached to any individual thing, and you could just take it all away tomorrow, as long as maybe you substituted my walls with other things and my closet with other old polyester vintage Adidas relics. Art is an encapsulate of kind of freezing the moment in time, socially, economically, politically, and in relationship to technology. In that regard, I'm interested in the moment that I'm living in. I look back with reverence to the past. I'm very much engaged with the present, but I always have a foot in what's next or trying to piece together all of the information I've accrued over the years of my life and my studies and my career, and then trying to forecast in what sense what's next, what's going to happen with art, what's going to happen with technology.
This near and far future thing. I mean, you've been, I want to save it a little bit, but this, I mean, you've been making digital work since the early 90s.
Like, yes.
You know, you've been presenting ideas that are quick and concept driven using digital tools forever. And obviously you were one of the first to really expose many of us to what NFTs were and just explain a basic idea of how this is changing things. But this near and far future idea. So around that, you know, I want to look at it in two distinct ways. First, in terms of art making, and not personally to you, but just in the history of it, what hasn't really changed since the beginning of art making?
Nothing has changed. Nothing. It's the human impetus to express themselves through creativity, which differentiates us as a species from pretty much everything. I'm sure there's some animal that makes some aesthetic choices in their life and makes gestures. But I think since art came off the wall of the cave, it's been coveted. For me, making art is like taking a crap or eating. It's sustenance. It's a way of living and a way of dealing with humor. For me, is more than a defense mechanism. It's a way of relating to the world. I employ humor a lot in my work because I also think it's a nice way to disarm people when you're being a giant asshole, like I'm prone to be. You know, everyone has a story about their life. It's funny because I was just doing this project where we're doing these intense studio visits on camera with the Smithsonian Museum. I'm the only one amongst these people doing these visits, relating to these. And I'm only interested in the formative biographical history of the person. Zaha Hadid became one of my closest relations in the world. I'm not an architecture fanatic. I never studied art, but I love personal trajectories, personal histories. Again, in relationship to time, life is so short. What do you do in that limited amount of time? How do you utilize your time? I love stories of people coming from adversity or not necessarily even that, and what you do with your space, how you mold your life and create these narratives. So for me, art is a way of just giving form to ideas, to experiences, and to time, especially. I wrote an essay about the artist Paul Tech, Nothing But Time, and there's two meanings to that sentence. Like, all there is in life is time, and it's very brief. And we have a lot of it when it's slowed down to a snail's pace. during the course of a given day, and sometimes it feels it's going slower than at other times. And then it's, what do you fill that time with? What do you do? How do you do it? Why do you do it?
Look at the Zaha building right there.
Oh, how cool. Oh, perfect.
Separately, I wanted to get a kind of assessment from you about the art market. You know, what is the most kind of basic or primordial aspect that hasn't changed about that,
greed.
Even amongst change?
Greed. I mean, people say crypto is rife with grift, tax evasion, money laundering, scams, cash grabs. Crypto is crypto. Crypto is a bunch of computers and a decentralized network of computers called the blockchain. People are fucked up. People have criminal intent. There's a bell's curve of morality and integrity in the world, and it drives people. So the art market, like social media, I mean, a lot of social media controlled by one, disproportionately controlled by one person, Mark Zuckerberg, who should be divested of his companies today because it's disgraceful, the amount of concentration of power, censorship, control. It's absurd. It's akin to like the robber barons in the turn of the century in post-industrial America.
Do you see him as the only, just quickly in terms of technology, because in a way technology is like our new religion at one point, maybe art was more closely tied religion, but technology as a kind of religion, and Zuckerberg is kind of a demigod or an all-powerful.
He's among those people like Bezos and
do you see
Amazon,
all of them
Google?
As authoring sort of corruption or problems in our world?
Well, I just think, you know, no one makes $100 billion being a nice humanist. So, yeah, there's an inordinate amount of greed and control and machismo and competition. And
do you believe that we're going to get into why NFTs matter, but that there are disruptions happening now and that things will change? Or do you believe that the art market is something that will never change in
things,
that way?
Things are always changing. I have never seen something transform with the rapidity of NFTs in particular over the last year and a half. Technology change, a year in technology is like dog years. So 1 year in technology is 15 years in real life. And everything was accelerated by the tragedy of COVID when people, if you wanted to have a window into the world, there was your screen. One day during the initial lockdown, I clocked over 16 hours of screen time on my telephone. I didn't feel remorse. I was quite happy with my personal best. Right. Because, I mean, again, like as bad as Instagram is and Facebook, extraordinary things have also come from it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be as popular as it is, despite the fact it's engineered to control our dopamine and serotonin release. I've met extraordinary people and created great opportunities for myself and for other people that through the kind of crushing of these geographical boundaries that never existed before the advent of social media. And I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, the democratization of it all and the access.
I mean, the access and the democratization are a little bit over exaggerated because of the algorithmic control of what you see and who gets to see, you know. So that's why the tech world is on Twitter and the art world is on Instagram.
Right.
And no one in NFT space, nothing would ever transpire from Instagram. It just does not happen.
Yeah.
You have to be on Discord and Telegram and
all these other spaces. Yes. So you're a self-proclaimed hoarder. You said it a few minutes ago. And when you look at the work you've collected, made, written about, does it have a sort of transformational quality for you? And what I mean by that is, do you kind of see your own history? Is there an autobiographical quality to the collecting of all of the things, whether made by you or not? Hmm. And how much does your collecting have to do with a kind of personal narrative?
I think all artists are vain narcissists. One of my kids called me, I love this one, the perfect, called me a narcissist with low self-esteem. I feature in a lot of my art, whether it's acting in videos or 2D photo manipulations. But if the art was strictly personal, I think nothing could be strictly personal because we're all, for worse and worse, interconnected on some level. We like to think of ourselves as unique and special, but we really just, everyone is fungible. You can't even say that word anymore after non-fungible token, but we're all fungible. Let's face it. I mean, we may have some degrees of distinction to differentiate ourselves amongst our peers, but more or less, we're comprised of the same elements and atoms. I mean, one artist that I frequently speak about and write about is Paul Tech, and he made these sculptures in the early 60s called technological reliquaries. His name was Tech, T-H-E-K, so that could have played into his nomenclature about his work. Of course, if you just made art about yourself, it could be a little dull and a little bit conceited. So I think that we use our own experiences and our own intuitive and intellectual reaction to things to convey an analysis and a message of what we see before us and what we see ahead of us. I mean, I wish I could make beautiful things because I'd probably have a much better art market. And my art, in a way, is some kind of a reportage. I did the only way I can have my work seen for the last 15 years when I started incorporating my videos into my writing to create my own platform when the art world afforded me no other opportunities. The work was illustrative to some extent, but art has to have, you know, art in the best of all possible worlds, you'd be able to live with a painting for your entire life or a sculpture or a video. So in that regard, this essence of, I mean, timelessness is some unattainable ideal in the same way beauty is. I found Paul Tech's cross-sections of meat. Some people found them revolting. I found them terribly stunning and seductive. I've never seen such a beautiful depiction of the fragility and the vulnerability in this line between life and death in a way that just stopped me in my tracks and has brought me to tears. So I think that, yeah, my art is referential to myself. I hope that it has some element that it would still have meaning in years to come.
Do you think the collecting, the work of other artists, is also a reflection of you?
It's a reflection of me in as much as I've made the decision to buy the stuff, but I'm really all over the place. And if you come into the room where I work, call it an office, there's 100 small pieces. The most valuable thing is a gift somebody gave me, but they're all among the most meaningful things to me. And I would say it's the closest representation of what a screenshot of the inside of my head would look like. It's a lot of information, like an atom smasher, all of these things colliding off of each other. Anyone else would be overwhelmed by being in that space, but it kind of quiets my mind and it puts me into a space where I could think about other people, think about writing. I've done a hell of a lot of lecturing over the last 2 years there. Since NFTs and since my early adaption in the space, I've given 30 podcasts and 50 lectures about technology. And to be very clear from the onset, I'm not a programmer, I'm not a coder, but I've always appreciated, I remember Heathkits, when the first personal computers available to consumers was the first Apple computer and the Heathkit kit to build your own computer. When I was in graduate school, I went to law school because I had a philosophy degree and there was nothing else to do other than teach high school. So I went to law school to hide from the marketplace and I got an IBM desktop before there were laptops.
Yeah.
Which is like saying, I remember when hamburgers were 5 cents and I had a floppy disk and I copied 1200 pages of notes on my word processor just to interact with this device. And then it changed my writing, has never been the same. It changes the way you constitute a sentence and the way you think about text.
Yeah.
And I love text and art. And
well, this is very logical in step with everything else, this idea of near and far future and this idea of really wanting to harness this moment and being super interested in this moment right now that you always seem to hit. Connected to the hoarding idea, you've been making these auctions, selling off your pieces or some of your pieces.
But I would say also, like, my collecting is not, you would never go through my collection and make any obvious associations to me as a human being, but they're just the things that are meaningful objects, relics, things that affect the way that I think. And I love to just every day I screw my nose up against a drawing, a painting, or a sculpture. I'll move something a centimeter. If one piece was moved in my house to one degree, I would notice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so during lockdown,
a form of play.
Yeah. But it's a form of thinking, of being. I mean, I love playing and I love touching and I love doing things I'm not supposed to do. And I'm always saying, I'm sorry, today not excluded, but I won't get into that right now. But I mean, I consider it like, yes, I like play because I never had a fabulous, fun childhood and I'm making up for that. Or I used to when I drank a lot and did a lot of drugs, which I don't do anymore. I mean, I just think of it more like a chess game where I'm making these moves and moving around things, looking at them in a different way, thinking about them in a different regard.
Activating them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've been doing these auctions, the hoarder auctions with Sotheby's. And what I was curious about when you did the first, I think it was 2 years ago. Three years ago when you did the first one was, how do you decide what you're ready to sell? How do you decide what to part with?
Well, like a lot of things in my life, it was half a joke. But again, like, I mean, I don't take myself or what I do seriously. I'm not curing cancer. I wish I was. Although clinical studies have found that living with art reduces blood pressure and lowers anxiety levels. And I did some work with a hospital in London that's accredited as a museum. And they have a very proactive commissioning process. So,
and the field of neuroaesthetics is exploding now, the work at Hopkins and everywhere else. I mean, yeah. This is science now.
I mean, I could not live without art. And like I said, it's imbued my life with meaning. But the hoarder thing came about as a kind of joke. After living for 15 years in London, I always would, I mean, at first I made an installation in this basement that I had. There's a famous brothers in New York, the Collier brothers.
The hoarders.
Yes, the hoarders. So I would see these articles in the newspaper of these older people generally that would fill their lives with so much junk that you could not enter the house, literally. And I always thought that I would be, I made a short horror film that was 3 minutes long where one trip I came back from being abroad and I looked around in my office and I just felt as if I was being suffocated by my own things. So I made a video where I fell down the stairs and my art collection like attacked me and killed me. So after living in London for 15 years, I literally like I had to shovel my way out of there. And in the same way that I had a gallery designed by Vito Conchi, like a project space, because I'm incapable of operating anything professionally, like being a gallerist. So I sold the gallery literally in two chunks at Phillips Design Sale. Again, like I was going to do it as a joke on eBay. And then I thought, fuck it, I'll just put it into a design auction when the design kind of market just came into fruition in 2004 at Phillips. So the hoarder sale was like, well, first of all, everything, I mean, I couldn't do it without being tongue in cheek and taking the piss out of Sotheby's. So I've made ads of myself dressed up in a plaid jacket as a used car salesman selling my stuff as in the guise of a Sotheby's ad.
Yeah.
And had a car on the floor of the sales room. Then I had a desk installed and I worked the floor, which was the first time in 275 years that a seller has ever behaved like that. And they made a desk for me with the hoarder and a name plaque on it. And I even wore the Sotheby's apron and was doing my kind of like, let's make a deal routine. But the idea was that I was being literally smothered by my crap. And in a way, look, I appreciate, I studied Freud and psychology and Freud has written extensively. He thinks collecting stems from like bad toilet training, which I don't think now is the time or place to get into how I wipe my ass. But you're definitely plugging some kind of, I mean, you know, there's some loss.
There's a connection to loss somewhere.
Yeah. And it's just like, I mean, I lost my mother when I was very young.
And at 13.
I was 13. And I guess it's kind of like compensating for, you know, for
filling
something.
Filling holes.
Yeah. So filling this kind of moral black, this emotional black hole with stuff and that never really works as is pretty clear. Anyway, so I was moving from London to New York in 2019 and I was inundated. It took 4 months to dig out. Then I just thought as a joke, I would have a sale at Sotheby's, like an online sale before online sales became so prominent during the tragedy of COVID. And then I just thought I'd call it hoarder. It was like a joke and I didn't know they would ever go for it. But there was this renegade guy who was working at Sotheby's before he got fired. And he kind of helped me facilitate having to call the hoarder and it did really well. And I didn't know, like I'm always the one to sabotage myself. So I made no reserves. And I mean, some people gave me pushback. How could you jeopardize a career or the market of some artist if you're selling stuff potentially for peanuts? But the only one who's going to suffer is me. And I've now done 3 of them and I haven't. I mean, look, more often than not, I've lost money doing it, but I don't have a regular stream of income in my career. Until now, I never made money selling my art. I had a show in a gallery in East Hampton, rental gallery in 2018 that did relatively well. surprisingly. Again, it was like a joke of a fake retrospective. My expectations always start 2 degrees below zero, in which case I'm rarely disappointed because that's normally how it ends up. And the show did well, but I haven't shown since then. And so The Hoarder is, for me, it's a necessary evil where I don't like to sell art. I'm not a flipper by nature, and I'd rather buy art than sell art. And I say I can't sell drugs to a drug addict. So I employ I love art dealers. I used to be very hypercritical about some of their activities, and I guess I still am. But art dealers make the leap of faith. It's a hapless job. It's a very difficult job when you have these behemoths like Zwirner and Hauser and Gagosian and Pace, and they're all, you know, it's like you're always looking over your shoulder or behind, and art is simply a zero-sum game. One person advances, whether you're an artist, a dealer, or a curator, or anything, even a collector, you advance at the direct expense of somebody else.
Yeah.
And relatively speaking, you mentioned Apple or technology companies, the entire breadth of a year's worth of the art market is what Apple does during lunch today, $65 billion.
What would you never sell?
My soul.
Not your Paul Tech sculpture?
I'm always desperate for money. I'm always up and down. I don't value money. I don't want to die with a lot of money. That would be a waste. Unfortunately, I've sold some of my most significant Paul Tech sculptures, but all of the Paul Tech sales I've ever had to do were to, one, a private museum, which is open to the public in Hamburg, Falkenberg's Foundation, and then to a museum in The Hague, most recently when I curated a show at Pace Gallery in London in 2013, working on another one. But honestly, I would never compromise and capitulate my beliefs. But again, like, I know it sounds stupid because where I'm living now is about to sink into its foundations from the amount of crap that's accumulating regularly now, since I've even moved here 2.5 years ago, close to three, I guess. But I wouldn't want to live in a house with no art.
Did you grow up in a house with a ton of stuff in it?
Zero. I did not know. I'm an idiot savant. My mother passed away. She was a bit creative. I just have one vague memory of her painting on the wall of the basement. My dad was absentee and unsupportive. He once tried, I worked all throughout law school, told everyone I was in night school. There was no night school. I worked on the floor of the stock exchange. I worked as a writer. That's how I honed my writing skills. I went into fashion. You would never know it from the looks of me. But I did all of these disparate jobs, all in the search of trying to find something that gave me some level of satisfaction. And I refused to have some kind of routine. I didn't want to live for holidays. I hate holidays now. If you gave me a 7-star trip to a beach somewhere, I would be mortified. Literally, I just can't compute.
I want to hear more about your childhood, though. Where did you grow up?
Wait, so just go back. What was the last question?
I was curious about what your house was like.
Oh, yeah.
That you
so
grew
no
up in.
When I was procrastinating, I passed the bar, took a part-time legal job. I was procrastinating between jobs. And,
but before that, I'm talking about...
Yeah, I know. But in a nutshell, I never went to a museum or a gallery in my life. Until I was
as a child, you were never taken.
I didn't know galleries existed until I was almost 27 years old.
But you grew up in New York,
in Long Island, which could have been like in Siberia,
right?
17 miles away, but 17 light years from.
Never came into the city. Went.
I
to
came
museum.
In to like go to. I mean, when I was overweight, I stuttered. The reason I never shut up now nor punctuate when I speak, I had a speech impediment till I was like 16.
From when you started speaking.
Yes. So I was very. I was
How
overweight.
Did you transcend
alienated.
That?
I lost weight. Then I would only go into the city to go to Studio 54 in Zenon when I was 16, steal my parents' station wagon, take a few Quaaludes, and become a disco thing.
How did you transcend the speech?
It just came over time and with the incremental buildup of confidence in myself. If I was called on in law school before I quit attending classes, certain letters like D, I would stumble over. It can... occasionally still sputter out, but
they say it has to do with how you feel that you're being perceived while you're thinking through the thought.
I mean, I've only become comfortable in my skin in the last couple of years. I was never really happy with myself and satisfied with myself and comfortable in my identity. And I mean, now that you're on a couch and I feel like I'm in a psychiatrist's office. But as a kid, I had no, when I was 14, after my mother passed away, we moved into a house and the room, the wall in my bedroom was covered in cork. I would frequently, as a child, cut out magazines. Like I've always been a journalism fanatic. I mean, and to this day, really, the art that I make stems from a very similar mindset of like taking pre-existing images. I hate fiction.
Yeah, you're like a storyteller of truth, like where we started.
When I lived in London, there are 9 daily newspapers. I was in heaven. I just, you know, after seeing some of the both the good and the terrible ways that people treat one another, like in the Ukraine today, and this brutal attack on people minding their own business. It's the World Trade Center and just various acts of inhumanity to animals and children. I've always just been fascinated by what people do with their lot in life and how they do it. As a child, I had everything from National Geographic to car magazines. And I hate sports. My biggest fear in life was we would play on a team. It would be shirts or skins. If I had to take my shirt off, I would be like paralyzed, incapacitated. I was so self-conscious. I guess I still have a few dysmorphic problems, but I would take these existing images, and the way Richard Prince would go in the basement when he was working for Time magazine and re-photograph these cowboys, I wasn't that clever, but I would just cut and paste the magazines and reconstitute them on my walls, even before I was 14, 13, 12. And in a way, I was creating my own reality and my own environment. And the work that I do today frequently also is cutting and pasting and recontextualizing
making sense
pre-existing
of
images, making my own sense of it, taking things the way they are and then reshaping them and molding them to address how I feel the way things are today. I mean, I would have to say I'm 50% interested in now and 53% interested in what's next. So I think you basically, all the knowledge I've accrued, I write to make the mundane experiences of my life more focused, and I teach to learn.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I wouldn't read books. I would sit home and watch cartoons all day.
Was there any kind of spiritual or religious background in your childhood?
No.
Zero.
Once my mother passed away incrementally of cancer, I gave up the hope of ever finding any spirituality in life. And I became, by default, a cynical existentialist. I always call myself cynically idealistic because I'm miserable, but I'm hopeful.
But at some point you met your wife, Alana, who's also an artist, and made your own family.
Yes. I mean, I love my kids. They give me great joy and satisfaction. I lost one of my kids 3 years ago, which, I mean, again, like it was so, I mean, my child had no issues, no problems, no psychological problems, no history of illness.
Is your son Kai?
Yes. He took his life and he was in he got into graduate school at Slade, one of the world's greatest art schools. He never went to undergraduate school, based on the merit of his portfolio. And after that experience, I mean, I can't say that I'll ever be happy again or have anything remotely resembling joy in my life. All I have is my work and my children. And that's it. It's enough because I have art and that is medicinal to me. But other than that, I mean, I got sober. I got focused. I love to teach. I love to help people.
You got sober after your son passed?
Well, before. One of my kids had some issues with drugs and alcohol, so I stopped drinking, but I was still using like marijuana habitually. And it sounds, you know, innocuous, marijuana, but marijuana today has the potency of class A drugs. When I was young, marijuana was like dirt from Colombia and you could smoke an ounce and nothing would happen. And now it's all engineered with THC content off the charts. And I think marijuana is an insidious, anything you habitually rely on is bad. And so I had quit drinking just for the sake of setting an example for one of my kids. Then when I lost my kid, who was like drugs had some role in his choices in life and his experience. And then I just couldn't look at marijuana anymore. And when I quit, it was such a crazy revelation because you do these things and they end. I mean, this is getting ridiculous.
No, it's fascinating.
I mean, I just feel like I had all these negative affirmations. My mother was gone and my dad would only ever relate to me when I did something bad. So lo and behold, I ended up being like, I never passed classes. I barely got into college. I barely got into law school, but that's because I had no intent. I never had a conversation like we're having till I was 14 years old when my mother passed away and my dad remarried. So I had zero positive input into my life ever. Everything has had to be a kind of a self-discovery.
Yeah.
So
and
I
survival.
Guess,
I mean, I don't think we should like just discount the fact that losing a parent at that age is a dramatic shift in your life forever.
And that was the only warmth and encouragement. And even my mother was kind, but she was hardly also ever, you know, didn't take me to galleries. We never went on holidays, never did anything. I had no hobbies. I had no interests other than ripping apart my magazines. That was it. And I'm not looking for sympathy or...
It's not about that. You're describing the forces that made you who you are.
Yes. So I wonder, like, not to sound like, to simplify anything, but in my writing, a lot of it, I mean, I've written articles blackout drunk. Some of that was readily apparent to anyone who got stuck reading it, but they were a little bit meaner than, a lot of my relationships stemmed from my criticisms in the press of people that I ended up befriending and becoming close with.
Recently, you reconnected with Lucian Smith and...
Right, and many people, that's one example. So I wonder, like, is that on some level me trying to get attention, because the only way I ever had any feedback from a parent was when I did poorly in school, which was regularly.
Whether it's get attention or just a way to engage with the world.
A way to be noticed, a way to posit any kind of my existence.
But out of this sort of...
You give me a headache.
...tragedy that we're talking about, you then built quite an enviable family structure for yourself, which is a response to that.
I love my kids so much.
And your whole... world, at least from the outside seeing, is this world where creativity and love and beauty is totally honored. And you even formalize that and sort of operationalize that in these exhibitions.
We started
on family.
back in 2014 or 12, I started doing shows with my kids. We traveled all over the world. With Kai, we did shows in California, in China, in New York, in London.
In 2012, it hit, national news. I think...
We broke a little Tracy Emin and we ended up in the Pakistan.
Yeah, I want to hear that story because, it was a show called Friends and Family where you engaged, I guess, your 14 and 13-year-old at the time.
All of my kids, all of their friends, and all of my collection. Cheek by jowl. And a few of their friends had bands, and that's where the trouble began.
So what was the idea of the show?
The idea was... Everyone in this day and age wants, whether it's like social media heroes and YouTube stars, it's asinine. And everyone wants to be famous and everyone wants to be rich, whether it's, the Kardashian model and NFTs. And, art is a slow burning process and takes a lifetime of, accruing an audience for what you do for good reason if you have good content. Anyway, so the idea was to do a show with my kids and engage them so they would do something positive and they wouldn't just want to hang around and get high and do nothing and somehow get noted for it. So we did the show and it was beautiful. I mean, it was extraordinary. And there was Richter and Polka and all these other artists beside like kids. Because frequently when I would curate shows in the early portion of my career, a lot of it, I have an aesthetic which is like, I love good, bad art. So, I've literally exhibited garbage bags filled with garbage by Rachel Harrison, who recently had a retrospective at the Whitney. And one of the refrains, which I was constantly confronted with, was my kid could do that, is blah, blah, this looks like shit. Well, it is shit, but it's still cool shit. So then I did the show with the kids, all their friends, and the only artist we actually borrowed a piece from, because most of it was mine, was Tracy Emin. She was gracious enough to let us into her studio, and she let us consign a small bronze piece, and it was encased in a glass box. And during the opening, there were a few bands playing. One was Anish Kapoor's kid, another one was, not to name drop, but Jude Law's kid, and some girl just like inadvertently knocked over a pedestal. It was like a beautiful opening. The show was, it was covered in the press and it was just, it really was the best of all worlds until we broke the Tracy Emin. And then before the glass was swept off the floor, an article came out in the Evening Standard. Dad has lets his kid throw a rave at a gallery. It wasn't even a gallery. It was a shitty space that I used to do pop-up shows in. And Tracy's piece was was could withstand nuclear conflagration. It was a little like bronze turd or something, and the glass box broke. Somebody called the newspaper. The next day it was in another newspaper. Then I had a call from the BBC radio, and they're like, you ruined it for all the other families that would have like been in the position of curating a show with their kids. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? We just, the piece is fine. Everything is fine. We did a nice thing. No one's going to be dissuaded from doing a show. So the headlines were blaring that. So Mike, I tried to encourage the kids to do something and get noted for positivity. And in the end, they were walking down the schoolway halls like the notorious kids that smashed the Tracy Emin. And it ended up in the Pakistan Daily newspaper. And I became enemies with Tracy Emin without even really knowing her terribly well. And she withdrew her pieces from the show the first day of the show. And it turns out it was the work of her studio manager. We were at a dinner party subsequent to that. And then I got into an argument with her friend and the party was in honor of her. And she threatened to leave the party. And so, and then she was bad mouthing me to some people that I knew in the art world. So it was really kind of a bad turn of events. I made some artworks about her, mocking the whole situation. She once married a rock. And so,
but you wound up resolving with her.
Well, the craziest story is that a few years ago, every single time I lecture, and including speaking to you, I will answer if anybody has any question, if I can help anyone without saying to me, how can I sell my NFTs? Because I can't fucking sell mine. I mean, I get the most, even you mentioned Lucian Smith. He sent me a DM and said, like, I want to be on Nifty Gateway. I'm like, manners, have some, say hello. And then I'll do anything I can to help you. And I do. And I would say, encourage anyone listening to this, if they're in any way I can give you any advice, it takes the same amount of time to say no as to just answer. And I answer every DM within 24 hours. 2 years ago, someone was DMing about art. And for 2 weeks, we were going on and on speaking about art and arguing and having a really engaged conversation about stuff. And it was a private account and I befriended it. I didn't know if it was a man or a woman. Or when they accepted my request, it turned out to be Tracy Emin. And since then, we've become really close friends. And I used to be super critical of her work and her practice. I made this piece where I'm cowering underneath her skirt, like shielding myself, because, you know, in America, we have Friday arts coverage in the New York Times, and that's it.
Yeah.
That is it. In the UK, because they have so many papers and they need to fill it.
And there's no Hollywood.
Yeah. Well, they have their own kind of alternative entertainment universe of people. But anyway, it's like they really, the artists like Damien Hirst and Tracy and Sarah, they're like, they're public figures in a way that doesn't exist in the United States. And every taxi driver knows who they are and what they've done pretty much.
So you're cowering underneath her.
So I was literally like, every time I would open the newspaper in the UK, there would be a profile of Sam Taylor Wood, who's now the director of 50 Shades of Grey and has gone Hollywood and married one of her young stars. It was either Sam Taylor Wood or Tracy Emin every week, a profile. So I knew basically diaristically what was happening in her life from 1 week to the next. And it was getting really tedious. Like, when's the last time you saw a profile of, say, Matthew Barney or one of, you know, I even did a book interviewing. This was all the impetus was having been in the UK and done some work there and seeing the way that artists are communicate and are embraced, whether it's for yellow journalism or their antics as much as for their art. But there's a wide degree of recognition in the same way in Germany, you would find an unlimited edition of Joseph Beuys in the house of people that don't go to galleries, that there was this kind of prevalence of culture in a way that disseminates way beyond in the United States. So I did a book in 2002 where I interviewed 100 people from Wall Street to Harlem, asking them, what does art mean to you? Do you know who Roy Lichtenstein is or Matthew Barney or Andy Warhol? What's your impression of creativity and art? And it was elucidating and an amazing project. So I had this piece where I was cowering from Tracy because I just thought that her art was so solipsistic. It was so self-aggrandizing and so much about, like, you know, exploiting personal experiences. And then when I came to know her and I really developed an appreciation for what she did, how and why, it completely transformed. And now I just think she's one of the greatest living artists.
Hi, everyone. Taking a quick break here to tell you a little bit about our Season 5 sponsor, Le Cole School of Jewelry Arts, which is supported by the Maison Van Cleef & Arpels. In addition to exhibitions, publications, research projects, and public events, Le Cole offers a range of courses led by experts across jewelry, craft, history, and the arts. Celebrating its first decade this year, Le Cole, which has permanent campuses in both Paris and Hong Kong, is opening a third space in Shanghai and another in Paris, which will feature a public library of roughly 6,500 reference works on jewelry and gems. At its main Paris space, Le Cole is also opening a gemothèque, or gem library, which contains some 1,200 stones for visitors to view and even handle. This year, they'll also be presenting 6 exhibitions in Hong Kong, Tokyo, and Paris, and publishing 8 books. You can learn more about Le Cole and its current and upcoming offerings at www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. That's www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. And now, back to the episode. You mentioned quickly, and we grazed over, you studied philosophy and political science at GW. So you were sort of DC at GW, and which is kind of a depraved art culture. I grew up near there. And then you come to New York to study law. And I think about philosophy and law, and I think about the things that you're doing in all areas of your work. And I wonder if you recognize that these skills you may have harnessed throughout your life in the way you can build an argument, in your convictions about ideas, in the way that you can construct the scaffolding around an idea, whether it's beautiful or not, it's the scaffolding. It's the raw construct of an argument. So you graze over studying philosophy and law as something that, whatever, I didn't have an intent. But do you recognize that you're possibly leaning on those skills on a daily basis?
You're way more interesting than I am. I'd rather just ask you about your childhood. Give me a headache. No, that's just a really fantastic question. And I don't graze over philosophy. I think what I'm doing is like an illustrator for a book, a grand book on philosophy. I love philosophy. And in college, procrastinating or after I smoked a joint, I went to the East Wing of the National Gallery and ended up frequenting the National Gallery. And that's where I began to see Warhol, Basquiat, Twombly, and all of this classic contemporary works. And it kind of subconsciously began to congeal in my mind and set the stage for my future. Law was like military school in gaining a discipline to teach myself. So that's a great analogy of the scaffold. In my own lame-brained, amateurish way, I consider like philosophy, conceptual art is giving form to philosophical thought and then ideations, making material ideational concepts. Again, like I'm not the most intellectual person. I just have a good work ethic. But philosophy, German philosophy in particular, colored like everything.
Heidegger.
Hegel colored everything that how I think and the structure. And then law school, even though I didn't attend the classes on a regular basis or on an irregular basis, I took the bar exam and I passed it. And that just wading through this institutional amount of material covering a wide array of subjects and having to memorize this material for this 2-day, 8-hour-a-day bar exam. If anything, I couldn't litigate my way out of a shoebox. I was a terrible lawyer, a walking malpractice with feet. I have an attention span like a mosquito. And literally, people who know me know if the content is not contained on one screen of a phone, very likely I'll miss it, not purposefully, just because I can't focus. But if I'm preparing for a lecture or writing, I could sit for days, listen to the same song 12 hours a day and give a 4-hour lecture, 3:00 in the morning in Switzerland, which I did recently. So I think law school prepared me for just focusing.
And rigor.
Yeah, I love discipline and I love the rigor. And like my dad, even though we don't get along and he literally tried to nearly forcibly dissuade me from an art career, he always said to me, do what you love. Just find what you love and do it. I don't care what it is. Well, I went to law school, found what I loved. It wasn't law. And then he literally sat in front of me at one of my exhibitions there. I was gallery sitting and said, you promised you would leave art if you weren't making a plausible living after a year. It's unbelievable. And I, of course, I never, I quit speaking to him and continued with art.
and you've done just fine. So it's been an intense, this is sort of a pivot, but it's been an intense few years, I think, for everyone, right? We've been speaking around the pandemic a bit, and everyone's processing it differently. So I was curious how it was for you. And, you know, sort of how you experienced it. What was your perspective on it?
Well, the thing is, like, I've been married for 25 years, but my wife and I haven't spent an enormous amount of time over the past couple of years. She was largely living abroad for a while I rented a place in New York. And look, I would never underplay the impact of COVID. And I'm a long-term COVID sufferer. I've had it twice. I had it the first time last October, over a year ago. And then I had it again, a lighter version in December, but thank God I didn't have it too severely. I was always late, but never going anywhere. So during the initial 3 months of the lockdown, I stopped wearing a watch. I'm still not wearing a watch. I think it absolutely changed the way that we think fundamentally about a lot of basic things in our lives, about time, about travel, about interacting with people, and about what was important, what wasn't important, and why.
Did you spend it with your family?
Well, for the first 3 months, I didn't move. It came to a point during my journalistic beat, I was covering art fairs and auctions for the most part. I was traveling every 2 weeks for 15 years, all the time. And in London, you're 2 hours away from everywhere. I saw Heathrow more than I saw London. Then I moved to New York. And so for the first 3 months of the lockdown, I just was homebound. I have to say, like, not to be dismissive or flippant about it, but it was a revelation that the hamster wheel came to a grinding halt abruptly. And I really started to look at the art in my house. I really started to think how I wanted to live the rest of my life. I didn't move. For the first time in my life, I was stayed put for 3 months. I taught nonstop. Even when I had COVID, I did a 2-hour FaceTime with Tracy Emin. I wrote an essay for a catalog for her work, for Zavia Hufkin's gallery. I taught in Istanbul. I worked nonstop, even when I was sick, because it mainly got worse at night. But then after that period, in May of last year, so well over a year ago, one of my kids was celebrating his 25th, and he was unhappy staying in New York. Kids were getting antsy, and he flew to London, and I got on a plane like 4 months into the pandemic. And I remember asking the stewardess if I could change seats. And she said, we'd have to see what the weight distribution is on the plane. There were so few people on the plane. I didn't think that was terribly nice thought to think about, that if one fat person moved from one side of the plane to the plane will tip over. So, and I have to say, like, once I moved early on in the pandemic, well, old habits are hard to change. And I did a lecture and a show with Johann Koenig in Berlin. And I just started incessantly traveling. And I've been traveling nonstop for the past more than a year and a half. So I'm teaching in Switzerland all the time. And I have an exhibition up now in Berlin with Nagel Drechsler Gallery.
Of your own work?
Yes. I've been moving around the whole time. I'm still not wearing a watch. I'm going to a hell of a lot less art fairs, unless I'm in them now. Who would ever think that you could transform your life in your late 50s? It's a very unheralded situation that I've strived for my whole life. And now it's happening and I'm grateful. Yeah. So I think the pandemic has been like a wake-up call to everyone to like reassess the importance of various things in our lives.
Well, in the last 24 months, your work, your own artwork, is garnering a lot of attention. It's really changed for a number of reasons. In both the traditional market and the NFTs, do you feel like your work itself has changed, or the work has always been the same, but the world around it has shifted?
By the way, I'm very grateful that you're so considerate and put so much work into this and even want to take the time to speak to me. So I'm very appreciative. Thank you. I think in certain formal respect, my work is exactly the same, but the content is wildly shifted. The only way that I can have my work seen in the past was to incorporate it into my journalism. So the work by nature had to relate. So I would say 95% of my work was relating to the art world. And that's kind of depressing. Art about art only goes so far and then it becomes incestuous. And I always say the art world is like picking up a rock and finding 300 incestuous worms all interconnected. And it's kind of gross and it's kind of boring. I love humor and I use humor in all my work, writing, teach. I mean, when I'm giving a 2-hour lecture, if I can't be entertaining and funny on some level, I've seen people go into deep REM sleep with puddles of drool coming out of their mouth, and that's not a good sign from an audience. So I would say in a certain regard, my work hasn't changed since I was pinning it up on the cork wall in Long Island when I was catatonic. But on another level, I mean, the content is completely changed. So now, I mean, because I've moved into the world, I had no interest in Bitcoin, crypto. I never done anything for money in my life, to the consternation of my family. But now I'm analyzing in a more in-depth fashion, and it manifests itself in my art, things about the crypto space, about NFTs, and how technology is ever increasingly directing and impacting on our lives.
Well, because it's not like fiat currency. It is not stable. It's active.
It's wildly volatile. And the rapidity of change, like I mentioned before, is unprecedented in life.
So let's get into NFTs. I wanted to save some space for that because we have one of the world's experts on it. You've been at the forefront, really championing its potential since somewhat the early days, at least the public early days of it.
Well, in the traditional art world, I would say among the first.
Yeah. What is it about it that drew you in initially?
The auction record for a video is $700,000 by Bill Viola. Nam June Paik sold a piece at auction for $1.3.
But that's a sculpture.
It was a sculpture with a video in it. Steve McQueen, the artist and filmmaker, his auction record, disturbingly, is $32,000.
He has an Oscar.
Correct. And he's one of the greatest image makers in the world has ever seen. His auction record is $32,000. That's disgraceful. Vito Acconci, one of my heroes, conceptual heroes, not just because he masturbated under the floor in 1972, which gave me pause to think that perhaps art could be a field for me since I was pretty
expert. Could find a home there.
I was pretty good at onanism. I own my onanism in Long Island, and I made a piece of an elephant sucking its own dick because I've tried it all in an isolated youth in the suburbs of New York. Vito Acconci died poor. He has his art in every museum of contemporary art in the world. And yet he was penniless when he died. Why? Because he flitted from one art-making form to another. He did a lot of videos and films and photography, and he never carried on making 3,000 of the same works like certain unnamed artists who paint a lot of spots. I've only ever been interested in technology as it relates to culture and the everyday presence and essence of our lives. So I always employed, like you said, I made digital animations in 1993. I started making digital prints in the mid-90s on vinyl, oversized and painted elements on top. I always made digital art, but digital art was the very, very, very poor cousin of painting. You couldn't flex to your hedge fund buds with a JPEG at that time. Nobody respected, regarded. There was no system mechanism for collecting digital artworks or videos, film, and the like. The auction record for a painting stands at $450 million. There's now a Warhol, which with the highest estimate ever given to an artwork at $200 million.
The bullet.
Well, that one wasn't shot, but it's in the category of shot Marilyn's because it was in the room. But it was unscathed by the... And I thought it was the woman that shot Warhol that shot
Valerie
the painting.
Solana.
But that's not... It was a performance artist that said to Warhol, "Can I shoot your work?" And he thought she was a photographer, and then she pulled out a gun and shot his paintings. That had nothing to do with his shooting. And it's a friend of mine, Doris Aman, who's passed away from malpractice, basically, at 7. She was wildly fit and healthy and tragically, prematurely died from a bad medical procedure. Anyway, it was, and her brother, Thomas Aman, was one of the legendary aesthetics in the world.
Aesthetes.
Thank you. From Long Island. Give me a break. As my kids will never let me forget when I try to say W-A-T-E-R, which I won't do now and have it recorded for perpetuity. Anyway, no one ever valued digital art because it couldn't readily be bought and sold. So when someone first sang those three letters to me a year and a half ago, I'm not a very technically minded person. I could barely get my phone to play. It took me 3 days to get my printer set up and my external speaker speaking. But I like the notion that you could sell a digital artwork. People complain. We can go through all the negatives, the environmental excessive footprint and consumption of energy, the grift and graft and money laundering and tax, all these things that are usually...
Name an industry that doesn't have
vulnerability. This is the province of the art world. That's why they were so pissed off. There was someone who was taking the wind away from their sales and stealing money more readily and easily. So I found out about it and it appealed to me. I've been making digital art for my whole fucking life and there was never a way to sell it. The art world begrudgingly after 15 years, once smartphones came along, started to take me, at least read me. I won't even say take me seriously because I'm not sure I do, nor anyone else for that matter. But basically the art world said collectively, like, okay, you could write, you could teach, but you'll never be an artist. Don't kid yourself. Literally, I'm not even being facetious. Someone mentioned NFTs. The chief financial officer of one of the large NFT platforms, Nifty Gateway, the chief financial officer at that point was also wearing a curator hat, which was absurd. But I called Tommy Kimmelman and I got my NFTs dropped on Nifty Gateway and they sold for $4,000. And I was just wildly appreciative and grateful because that's $4,000 that I never would have seen. Then they scheduled another drop for me. That was in December of 2020, and the next drop was 3 months later. I was writing I've now written over a dozen articles on digital art and NFTs for Artnet. I think Artnet is not terribly pleased that I've quit. I never set out to be stealing information from the rich and giving it to the aspiring rich like some kind of fucked up Robin Hood figure. I mean, I had death threats. I had people trying to beat me up, sue me, cancel me, some really awful things because I was telling all the dirty secrets of billionaires. One Russian, that was the only time where I actually ever feared for my life and had to send an intermediary to meet with this person to dissuade them from murdering me. I mean, and his brother was known as the Golden Gun in Moscow. And I'm not even exaggerating when I tell you that I was frightened. In London, like people get poisoned on a regular basis there. And this man was, anyway, by the second drop, I was expecting another 4,000 and my work sold into the six figures. And that was during a particular boom, but I've had a few other successes that even surpassed that over the past year. I had no interest in going into NFTs to make a quick buck. I just wanted to make a buck, not like a million of them. I had no intention, no expectations.
It was just like a trusted pipeline for you to take your work and get it to an audience.
It was a new and different pipeline of non-trolling haters that would not judge me for being someone who had to deal work to keep a foothold into the art world. I'm no great fan of his work per se, but the fact that his dumb piece sold for so much money, I mean, there's one thing the world understands and that's big numbers. And that's what people think about art. Why would someone pay a ridiculous price for something that a five-year-old could do with $6 of pigment on a canvas?
But it doesn't cross over. You know, there's this story about people approaching Larry Gagosian to be represented by him.
Yeah, I wrote that story. People said to him, literally, I'll make you a shitload of money. And that's just Larry has a shitload of money. So Larry does what Larry wants, and he's not down with NFTs yet. His gallery is sniffing around it. Hauser's going to do it. The art world turned a blind eye because they, like I said, art is a zero-sum game. And the art world has one power, and that's controlling access. Who gets to buy, who gets to sell, who gets to show. And the art world was very suspect and reticent about a new system, a new model where, I mean, it's a cliche in the space about empowering an artist, but artists were enabled. And also, like, you know, whether you like it or not, the market cap of Bitcoin at its height was $3 trillion. That's a fuck of a lot of money. So all of this money literally spun from thin air, came into being, and like a pent up child at a toy store, like there was nothing to spend the money on until NFTs happened. And then the floodgates burst open. And in the last year, the market went in 2 years from zero to $40 billion, soon about to eclipse the breadth of the fine art market. And the art world it's so stupid. It's typically The buyers of fine art were typically white, old, rich people. And now there's been enormous inroads in terms of artists of color, women, people of different sexual identifications, having opportunities to showcase their traditional fine art in ways and levels that never existed before. But like this whole crypto crowd, that's money that was never interested in art. Still, 70% of the NFT market is collectibles. The frogs, the unicorns, the hippos, the turtles, and all these other asinine. I mean, it's funny
how like,
yeah, we're reversing into this kind of infantilism where grown people are talking about apes and frogs and Pepe. It's fucking absurd. And the most successful fine art is like Kaws and Daniel Arsham toys. Connoisseurship and these types of things are on the wane because people don't have the time to study and to learn and to apply themselves to understand and appreciate the nuanced and the sublime nature of what art could really be. But again, I don't begrudge anyone. I mean, these people are also brilliant practitioners, and Pete Banksy gets a lot of shit in the traditional fine art world. But among those like kind of street type mentality artists, I think his art is filled with content and quite interesting. I really
and humor.
Like it. Yeah. And I grew up with it in the UK over 20 years, like seeing it on the walls in the East End of London and grown to really appreciate it. I mean, you're an idiot if you pay £15 million for one, but it doesn't detract from the nature of his work, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, agreed. What do you think people get wrong about NFTs?
Everything. There's no art in NFTs. I've seen brilliant artists that are utilizing crypto before NFTs, smart contracts as the conceptual underpinning of various pieces, Raya Myers, who used to identify as Rob Myers, Kevin Abash, Sarah Friend. There's a host of great talent, but nobody looks. People love to dismiss things. It's so easy to recoil from applying yourself to take the time to understand and appreciate. It's so easy to say that all NFTs look like screensavers and video games.
What about the transference of physical to virtual and the work Tom Sachs is doing and others? Damien, you mentioned that his version...
I mean, if they're making mediocre art in the traditional sense, they're going to be making mediocre art in the NFT sense, but all the power to them. People should do whatever they want. And I'm not in any position to, you know, to tell anyone not to. But I just think what people get wrong are, number one, no one gauge. I mean, Damien Hirst, you just mentioned him, is installing a 60-foot sculpture in London right now. That is displacing volume in the universe to the extent that 1,000 NFTs wouldn't displace consumption-wise, and bronze and shipping crates. I'm not rationalizing or condoning.
No, but we have a hard time understanding the
nobody
big
gauges.
Picture.
Yeah. No one, I mean, it used to be that you would gauge the success of a given Basel Art Fair according to how many private planes were in the parking lot. And I mean, there's never more than 2 to 4 people typically on these planes. Look, if you turn a blind eye to global warming, you're a moron. And these issues are among the most pressing issues of our time, along with racism and these kind of crazy, capricious political situations we're in, and Trumpism and extreme right-wing sentiment in this country and abroad. There's all kinds of hideous problems, but NFTs are not one of them. I mean, when you look at the lion's share of the environmental damage is from mining Bitcoin and the Ethereum. Ethereum 2 has been in the pipeline for ages and it's near completion. That will ameliorate all the environmental issues.
I mean, watching Netflix is a major carbon impact.
Everything is.
Yeah. Every time you take a digital photograph, there's a carbon impact.
Of course.
I think like, people don't understand.
Yeah. So there's hacking and security issues and content issues. But I've had my bank account hacked. And it was an art ruse where they like copy your language that you communicate with your financial institution. Then they, in your voice, in your email, they try to extract your money from your bank. And of course, I didn't have enough money to suffer the loss of a couple hundred grand, but that emanated from Asia into as a hack in my account from Hong Kong. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Again, like I said before, it's people that are problematic. It's not NFTs. And there are more and more dedicated devices to experience the work that connect to your wallet, freestanding TV devices.
It'll all come out.
Of course. Soon there'll be like holographic projections of sculpture into real space where you can view your digital works. I have a bespoke display from a young Korean artist, Taiwo Park, which is an NFT. And when I turn my light switch on, it goes on automatically. I'm a prude when it comes to art. I have to admit that I've not been a great fan of art that needs to be turned on, because frequently they only get turned on during a cocktail party or when there's people over. And for me, art is like reading the book or reading a newspaper. I need to look at my art every day with as least amount of effort as possible. That's why when I turn my light switch on, the digital art goes on. And then I get to just inadvertently enjoy it in the same way. I love drawings. I'm very non-hierarchical in my life. I love the democratization of art forms, and I have posters are hung next to sculptures and paintings.
Sitting
and
with
prints.
Design.
Of course, a car. I had a car under my desk in London. I just like things that are well done with love and passion.
Yeah. You said everyone and their grandmother wants to make NFTs, and then you sold your grandmother.
I minted my grandma and let her go too cheaply. It's one of my best pieces, I think. There's a low barrier to entry, which is great. If more assholes made art, they would be less inclined to kill people and shoot schools up.
But that piece wasn't about it being a race to the bottom.
Pardon?
That piece was not about it being a race to the bottom or us being in a bubble. It was about...
I don't believe in bubbles. I ate a dozen tulips to prove that fact. And I had someone on standby in case I keeled over because the core of the tulip is quite poisonous. That wasn't a race to the bottom. That was a race to the top. I love my grandma, and I thought it was a really cool piece. And it was just a symbol or a metaphor for the fact that, like Joseph Beuys said, everyone is an artist. Maybe that was before NFTs, and he would rephrase that, having seen how low effort it could be done. But why shouldn't, when I did this book about what do you think about art, if you're cutting hair, you're an artist. If you're doing anything with care and attention to detail and love, then it's art. What is art? I mean, art to me, I have a car designed by Zaha Hadid in the exhibition I curated downtown. That's art for me. Of course, I'm not going to say that I like the art that I like, and it has to be good on some level. How you define good is another story, but...
Yeah, but the conversation of is it art or not, I mean, it's
fucking ridiculous. I have a poster by Christopher Wool. If it was on paper and ink, it would be $2 million. It was substantially less than that, I assure you. And I get the same degree of pleasure looking at them.
You always have so much going on. And something that I'm looking forward to is the Independent Art Fair. Can you talk about what you'll be doing there and what we might be seeing?
It's funny because when you're looking for a partner in life, you can't find one. You make a lot of rings around the disco looking to hook up with someone. But then when you're with someone, then you seem to have all these other opportunities fall in your lap. When I started to create a career based on my NFT practices, then I ended up with two gallery shows in the last year, one in Greece and one in Berlin, which I curated a show for Nagel Draxler in Cologne. Well, now I have the opportunity to do an installation in the Independent Fair in the first week of May. And it's very exciting. I mean, it's difficult to negotiate when there's different galleries that you're involved in. But it's thrilling to me because it's like a kind of coming out party. And I mean, I'm sure I'll face a lot of resistance and I'll get criticized. And
do you know what you're showing?
I'm going to make an installation, which I've been doing, which is like, there's a great exhibition, which I'm super excited, at the Hirshhorn Museum in D.C. of Laurie Anderson. And she's created this all-encompassing environment. And when I had my exhibition in Long Island in 2018, when you write online, even though it has a shelf life of carbon 14, at the same time, it's off the main page in 10 minutes and it gets buried only if someone is consciously looking for it. So I made this environment where I covered the walls, the floor, and the ceiling with text. And in a way, it was almost like a virtual reality experience.
Very beautiful blue. I mean, it wasn't actually how you would have seen it.
No, I kind of aestheticized it.
Yeah, you gave it a look.
But still, it was a really cool, non-narrative way to dip in and out of reading a paragraph and a sentence. And it gave an architectural form to writing in a way that didn't exist before. And it gave another life to my writing. And I love making that kind of environment that transforms you to a different space and gives a new material form to writing and words. I love text and art. Anyway, so I've now done probably nearly a dozen installations like that.
On that strategy.
Yes, at the Basel Art Fair in Switzerland, at the Basel Fair in Miami, in exhibitions in London, in all over. So I'll do something like that. And then I'll, like my show in Berlin right now, you would think A, that it's a group show, and B, it's comprised of tapestry, which is one of the most ancient art making forms, and painting, which I can't paint. I get them fabricated. But everything derives from a digital file. And part of that notion is to dispel another inaccuracy about digital art, that it could only be experienced on a phone or a computer. Everything in my house, in my studio now, there's a sculpture of me like Saint Sebastian impaled with all these selfie sticks. Everything came from a digital file. I made, when COVID first happened, I wrote an article and said, the art world is such a beast. There'll be art fairs in emergency rooms in the hospital. And then I created one in a collage. And then somebody called me and asked me to buy the Corona Nurse, a kind of fake Richard Prince painting. So I had one made. And then I made another version when I broke the story that Jeff Koons got some crazy COVID loan, even though he's one of the richest living artists in the world today. He made these paintings with blue gazing balls, or sculptures with these blue mirrored balls attached to them. He was being photographed naked by Annie Leibovitz in his studio while all his assistants were slaving away at his paintings, and they were all shackled by these gazing ball and chains. And then I made a sculpture out of that. So all of these things derive from, mainly, I can only create with digital tools at hand.
I heard a rumor that Chris Smith is making a documentary about you now.
Yeah.
Amazing. One of the great documentary filmmakers right now. I mean, he's made some of the most entertaining films in nonfiction in the last few years. How did that come about? How's the experience of making it?
Well, like everything, I'm pretty good at like sort of manipulating things to put my own self-interest in a way, benevolent, of course. But like one of my close friends stole a lot of money from me between like 2012 and 2015. And then he stole money from a very dear friend of mine. If he had stolen money from me, Indigo Philbrick, I wouldn't have cared about it because we made money, we lose money. I don't really care. But then he was very disregarding of an introduction I made to him of a friend, and he stole money from them, and he just was very like brushed it off with such nonchalance. It infuriated me because really I never understand why people do things like that.
Again, it's back to truth and justice.
And it's also like I have respect for people. I believe in the humanity of others. When it comes to helping other people, like I said, like I think like half of what I do as an artist is inspiring people, whether it's talking about suicide and trying to help people that have gone through experiences or feel experiences. And I've had this, I can't even define it, the experience I've had of losing a child like that. The first time I spoke about it, my three kids were in the audience at School of Visual Arts and I was in tears. But then I get feedback from people that these things are like, they're unspeakable and it's a pariah issue to even discuss. And I think that when you could be frank about these things and express yourselves, it's very reassuring to people. And in that regard, if one positive thing can come from such a heinous experience, then that's a good thing. And turning it into some form of a positive, that's really important to me. And I'm just, like I said, I thesis advise, I mentor people. I just want to give back.
So the film.
So my dear friend stole a lot of money from me. And then I got really pissed off at him because we were communicating when he was on the lam. He would get in touch with me with various aliases. Then I would figure it out and I would start to like ask him a few sneaky personal questions to assure his identity. And this went on for a year. And then I wrote an article for New York Magazine, a feature, and I kept the rights to the article. And it was a tell-all article about this asshole's behavior. And I got an agent and all of these people wanted to make films. And because of the kind of increasing popularity of documentaries, and especially after The Tiger King, which Chris Smith was an executive producer of, in the end, after thinking about it, after initially agreeing to a conversation with Chris, he went to art school and studied fine art, so I felt an immediate kinship to him. And he did the American movie, which I really related to this. I mean, I'll always think of myself as this self-sabotaging failure. And in a way, I'm like a successful failure right now in my life, you know, but we'll keep off the couch for the next 5 minutes. And anyway, so I spoke to Chris, and out of all the people that contacted me, people from all the big companies, Imagine and Sony and all of these other companies, he was the most attractive because of his experience with fine art. And then after giving it some thought, I didn't want to spend 6 months of my life dwelling upon such a negative experience. And it's such a mischaracterization. When you think about Goldman Sachs, there's more crime. Like with Joe Lowe, the Malaysian 30-something-year-old who stole $10 billion from taxpayers in Malaysia, that dwarfs the crime in the history of art from the Renaissance. But everyone like Anna Delvey, which to me is the dullest, most pretentious, banal, inane story I've ever heard in my life. That's three TV series. I mean, I should go to jail if that's the key to success on that extent. So then I spoke to Chris, and I after agreeing to potentially exploring a project, I changed my mind, which I'm wont to do on a very regular basis. And I just decided I wouldn't do it. And I said, like, you know, the art world is not comprised of this cliched stereotype of criminality and these nefarious people like laundering drug proceeds. So I got them to change the idea for the film that it would touch upon some of the bad, but it would give a broader perspective about my life in the art world. And it happened to coincide with the onset of my NFT life. And we interviewed one of the founders of OpenSea, who went from living in a dingy, I barged into his apartment unannounced with the crew, and he was eating Chinese food in a studio apartment. And I just found out yesterday that this guy is worth $2.2 billion now. And we interviewed the founders of Nifty Gateway and a bunch of crypto artists. I think all along, Chris Smith, he's done the Fyre Festival, Varsity Blues about the high school cheating scandal, Tiger King 2. The whole while, I had a very sneaking suspicion that he was hoping that I would get arrested and Inigo would try to throw me under the bus and concoct some story, and I would end up being taken away in handcuffs, and that would have been the perfect ending to the film. Thankfully, knock on wood, that's never happened so far. And Inigo is being sentenced in the next week or so to like between 10 and 20 years in prison. I mean, amazing to think he got more time than most murderers get in this country. But that says something more about the country we live in. So this film has been shot across three countries over the course of over a year. And now it's being shot to Netflix and HBO. Amazing. And it covers me sitting at the desk at Hoarder 2, curating my first NFT exhibition in Cologne during lockdown, interviewing artists like Tracy Emin in London, and my one-person show in Berlin, the opening, and various points in between my teaching, all the other kind of activities that I think I was interested in painting a broader picture. I love art. It gives me chills when I see art today. Art has given, like I said, meaning into my life. Even though I'm cynical and I complain and I'll moan and groan, the longer you have, the more war stories I'll relate to you. But I get the same visceral experience standing in front of art that I like that I did 35 years ago. I love it. As there has been no diminishing in how I feel about being involved in the arts. And I would love for my kids to be involved professionally, all of them. One of them is kicking and screaming that he, even though he's a great painter, Gabriel, he's in my show on Morton Street now, but he's fighting it. But I would be thrilled. My oldest, Adrian, has a major show in Florence in September with the grandson of Cy Twombly at his gallery. My youngest switched to art. He's at School of Visual Arts now where I teach. He's in my exhibition. My wife is in my exhibition. Amazing. I'm in my exhibition.
Of course.
You could be in my next exhibition.
I can't wait to see the film. I'm very much looking forward to it. Kenny,
I'm scared to know what it's going to look like, knowing Chris and his inclination to paint moral pictures.
Yeah, but you know,
I shudder.
He's going to pull something off, I think.
I'm sure.
Kenny, thanks so much for coming in to spend time with us today. It's been a real pleasure.
You're such a kind and conscientious person that I'm very honored to be sitting here talking to you, and I'm very grateful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Extra thanks to our Season 5 sponsor, Le Cole School of Jewelry Arts, which is supported by the Maison Van Cleef & Arpels, a unique place for learning. Le Cole welcomes the general public to the world of jewelry through courses, conferences, exhibitions, videos, and book publications. You can find out more about LeCole at www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. That's www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. And thank you for listening. You can find more episodes of Time Sensitive on our website, timesensitive.fm, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can listen to our other podcasts at a distance by heading to atadistancepodcast.com. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. And if you like our programs, please be sure to subscribe and leave comments. Our theme music was composed by Billy Martin. This episode was produced by Mimi Hannon, Emily Jang, Tiffany Zhao, Mike Lala, and Johnny Simon.